Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. And in case you have not heard, we are now taping this podcast from Las Vegas because I have relocated. I mentioned casually on the podcast a week ago that I was moving, but we announced it this week. Daily Wager crew is relocating to Las Vegas because we unveiled our brand new studio at The Link, which is across the street from Caesars. We knew about it for about a year that we were building it, but we never officially announced that we were moving the entire show. So Christina, I'm joining you from Las Vegas for the first time on this podcast.
First and foremost, congratulations. I can imagine the weather and everything out there is a little bit nicer, maybe more interesting than here in Connecticut.
Yeah, a little bit more happening in the scene down here, the glitz and glamour, the neon jungle. But thank you very much. Obviously, we knew about this right before COVID, and then everything hit with all of that, and we weren't really sure in terms of a timeline, the sports calendar, and trying to process it all. But, you know, we kept our glass half full approach, and here we are, and it's exciting, and we got a lot of work to do and all that fun stuff. But the studio looks awesome for those who haven't checked it out. So really fortunate to have this opportunity with the team, and we got a lot of fun ahead of us as well. So I'm excited. Obviously, I lived here for 7 years from 05 to 2012. So it's good to be back reconnecting with a lot of friends. Got dinner last couple nights with buddies, and it's good. It's good. I will miss Connecticut. I will miss the campus. And Christine, I'm sure you miss the campus right now because we're not really going to campus. I was for a few sports center hits here and there, but certainly unique times right now. But I did love my 8 years in Connecticut, and who knows what the future has in store. But I'm out here and ready to rock, and we are going to rock this podcast as well. Wes Reynolds coming up with golf. Gee, what do you know? He picked another winner. DJ just dominated from that, whatever he shot, a million under. I mean, he went 27 on the front nine on Thursday, but dominated. So Wes was on that 20-1. He's got some more plays for this weekend. I only have one, and we got Lou and Matthew back again to break down the UFC card, and we're going to get into all that exciting content coming up. Obviously, the NBA playoffs have been thrilling. We'll probably do another playoff preview, I want to call it, assessment, maybe before the conference finals. That's probably what we're going to approach. But let's get to it. But before we do, I have my fantasy draft on Sunday, and you guys might have yours coming up in a little bit. We want to remind everyone, with the much-anticipated start of the 2020 football season just around the corner, make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
Time now to break down the UFC Fight Night card. And we took a little bit of a break last week. Obviously, the UFC's been fantastic, carrying us through the summer. And this is the last fight card of August. But the gentlemen are back. I think it's interesting to kind of bounce opinions off one another. So we're going to try this three-man tag team style for this card as well. So, fellas, good to connect with you. And let's start with the main event, work our way down the main card, and then maybe take some top plays from the prelims as well. Now, in terms of this main event, I'm obviously not surprised. Raukic is favored, but I'm surprised the line's this high, -$3, -320 in this light heavyweight main event. Lou, are you surprised at this line, and how are you planning to play this?
Well, first of all, good morning, Matthew and Doug, and thanks again for having me on. This is great. This is a super card at the Apex. And as I look at this main event, a little bit of a theme this year, we're finding some mature fighters with experience fighting brash, physical, explosive young up-and-comers, and that's exactly what we have here. Anthony Smith, really a seasoned professional, been fighting professionally since 2008. He's had 48 fights. He's 33-15. Meanwhile, on the other side of the cage standing from him is an Austrian who's a 28-year-old man, 4 years younger than Anthony Smith. That said, his record's 12-2. So not only has he much less fight experience, especially big time experience or main event experience than Smith, he's also faced really much less stringent competition. In his last fight, he entered as undefeated in the UFC, Volkan Ozdemir, who at the time was ranked eighth in the light heavyweight division. He lost via decision, learned a lot in a three-round fight because prior to that, all his fights in the UFC had ended in the first round. So Rakic may be the more explosive man. He's going to be dangerous with strikes, dangerous kicks. He lands at 5.1 strikes per minute, only accepts 2.4. So in his 14 pro fights, he walks his opponents down. He can also take his opponents to the ground and work from the top. Meanwhile, Anthony Smith, the much more well-rounded fighter, has a much more accomplished black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Therefore, his ground game is much more accomplished. This should be an interesting fight. And if Anthony Smith can season his way and make this through the first round where Rakic is his most dangerous, I think that the fight turns to Smith, and I find value on his price. I also really feel the over 1.5 lined at minus 145 or 150 is the stronger of the two plays for me, because I think this is going to be a very competitive fight. And though Anthony Smith is coming off a loss, I think there's compelling reasons to be able to throw out that Glover Teixeira fight in his last outing.
I like both sides of that what Lou said. I like Anthony Smith here. I think on paper, this line is way too high. My only concern is when we broke down the Daniel Cormier versus Stipe Miocic fight, we talked about the damage that sometimes fighters take, and when they come back too fast off a devastating knockout loss, it can be a detriment. And this is Anthony Lionheart Smith's second main event now during the COVID. So second main event in just 3 months for Lionheart. But what worried me about that Glover Teixeira fight is he didn't just lose. He was winning that fight, almost got a finish in the first round. He gassed terribly, and he took a terrible beating. If you remember that Glover Teixeira fight, the social media was outraged that it wasn't stopped earlier because he took an unbelievable beating. And when you take a beating like that, I worry about coming back in just a couple of months and what he's going to be like. How durable is he going to be? But I agree with both sides here. I think that this one is most likely to get the over here. Lionheart Smith, a tough kid. He's tough to get out of there quick. In fact, I think if it's a first round finish, it's more likely to be Lionheart Smith catching Rakic in a submission, as Anthony has an unbelievably underrated submission game. But I also like the over here. I think Lionheart Smith on paper is certainly the right side. He's only lost to the best in the world his last 10 fights, John Jones, Glover Teixeira, Thiago Santos. We don't know if Rakic is in that category yet. They do have a common opponent in Volkan Ozdemir, who Rakic lost to. Anthony Lionheart Smith was able to finish Volkan Ozdemir by submission. So we do have that common opponent reference. I like both sides. I agree with Lou. My only concern is I'm a little less bullish on Anthony Lionheart Smith just because of the quick turnaround off what really was a beating against Glover Teixeira.
Yeah, a lot of people think the fight should have been stopped in the, way early. What was a fifth round TKO? And, not all victories in this sport are created equal. So that should have a lingering effect. We've talked about it over the time. You guys just touched on it. But there is a path to victory for the underdog. Matthew, that's something we've talked about often. So no surprise Lou is on the dog, but I would, you do think that, that's something we've talked about. He's a 3-1 dog. So it's almost, if there is value I mean, there is like a temptation, I guess I should say, with Smith.
I think temptation's a better word than value here.
Yeah.
If I may add, what many people miss, and I think it's very legitimate that the market is concerned with the condition of Anthony Smith moving into this fight. I believe that's the reason we're getting the value on this. And what I will bring up is that 2 weeks before that fight, Smith was sleeping in his home with his family, and a drugged out 22-year-old wrestler broke into his home. Smith had to physically accost this man in front of his family until the cops came. And now, you tell me a man that has to explain to his children what happened, calm his wife down for the safety of her family, and then prepare for a fight. I completely give Smith a pass for his mental condition going into the Teixeira fight. And while I do concern myself with the beating he took, I also know that Smith's a very cagey veteran, and he's embarrassed off his showing. And I believe that it will manifest itself in focus in this fight. And rather than think that, rather than concern myself with how much of a beating he took, I think mentally he shows up very sharp. And that's really why I like the over. And that's also why I think there's a compelling reason to think that Rakic is getting a little bit too much love a little too soon.
Okay, fair points across the board. Let's go to the next fight on the card, co-main event, if you will. And this is, I always smile when I see Robbie Lawler on the card. He's originally from Bettendorf, Iowa, which is one of the Quad Cities, border of Iowa and Illinois. And that's where I started my broadcasting career. So I landed there in 2001. Well, I actually started earlier, but Miletich Fighting Academy was there, and we started doing local stories because my station was right around the corner from that. So all those guys, Tim Sylvia, Jens Pulver, Matt Hughes, Robbie Lawler, were all training at that gym. And obviously we all know what the UFC was back in 2001 to 2005 when I was there. So Lawler and I have just, you know, kind of paralleled, and I've seen him continue fighting nearly 20 years. And it's always cool to see him because he takes me back to when I started, because the other guys, Hughes, Sylvia, Pulver, are no longer still in the UFC. So it's really cool to see him. What are you guys expecting here? Because Neil Magny's obviously the favorite for good reason, minus 240. He has an advantage with the reach and height. I think he's going to be a little too much for Lawler in that. I mean, this guy's at the tail end of his career, needless to say. He's lost three straight. So, Matthew, we know Lou might lean to the dog here. We'll get his opinion in a sec. But I think there's actually value here with Magny, even at minus 240.
It's tricky because on paper, if you look – theoretically, what are the type of fighters that Neil Magny struggles with? So Neil Magny's 8-3, his last 11 fights in the UFC, the losses to Santiago Ponzinibbio, Lorenz Larkin, Rafael Dos Anjos. All three of those guys, especially Dos Anjos, when Magny fought him, were bangers that could really, that were power punchers. And that caused Magny a bunch of trouble because his game is use that length, use that height, use that reach. Get in the clinch where he has that tough Muay Thai game with how long his limbs are. And Lawler is a knockout puncher. We're talking about a guy who's 28-14 with 20 knockouts, but those knockouts haven't come lately as he's aged. He's now 38 years old. Four of his last five wins are by decision. And on the other side, so in the total on this fight, 2.5 rounds over minus 210 tells us that it's supposed to go the distance. Lawler's 38. He hasn't carried the power with him. He's only had one knockout win since 2014. That's Rory McDonald. So for everybody who's saying Magny struggles with power punchers, Lawler is a power puncher. Lawler's only had one knockout win in the last 6 years. It's just as he's aged and fought in at higher weight classes, the power isn't necessarily there anymore. And because of that, I worry about, can he win a decision against Neil Magny? And I'm not sure that 38-year-old Robbie, who has absolutely been through wars, the reason Robbie Lawler is one of the 10 most popular fighters all time in UFC is because of the wars he's in. He is the Arturo Thunder Gotti of the MMA world. And because of it, his fan base is immensely loyal, but I'm with you. I think that Magny's reach, Magny's clinch game, Magny's Muay Thai game, just poses a lot of problems for a 38-year-old Lawler. And at the end of the day, I think it's Neil Magny via unanimous decision.
So, Lou, I imagine you're on the underdog here?
Doug, I do my best to uncover underdogs that are going to offer me value. And I don't believe Robbie Lawler offers me value here. And I'd love to add a lot to what Matthew said. It would just ruin it. That was a magnificent breakdown. Magny also has a wrestling game. I believe he tries to wrestle Robbie Lawler. If he does get in the clinch, or Lawler does make his way inside, Lawler has 65% takedown D, and recent wrestlers have been able to take him down pretty easily. The last thing I'll add is that 10 years ago when Magny was starting out, he wandered his way into the Quad Cities, where, by the way, my mother is from. Ooh. And he trained with Robbie Lawler and crew there. And it was Lawler and that crew that made Magny realize that he wasn't as hot an athlete and up-and-comer as he thought he was. And he looks back very favorably on those times. So these men know one another and have been in the cage with one another. But I totally agree with Matthew's breakdown.
Great stuff. Where did your mother attend high school?
Oh, there's no way I can remember that. The family moved when she was young to Dubuque. And okay. What I remember from Dubuque is a hotel called the Julian. But what I also remember about the Quad Cities was that there was a boat there, and we would often go there to find our way into gambling. Listen, even in the heart of the Midwest, you can go find a card game somewhere, gentlemen.
Yeah, there's a boat in every city. On each, so I lived in Rock Island, and Jumers is right there. So I was about a 3-iron from the entrance to the casino there, my loft downtown there. So there's a lot of opportunities there, and obviously I felt right at home there. Let's keep it moving, though, as we get way too sidetracked. We have another similar favorite. It's going to be the theme on this card. First women's fight on the card that we're going to discuss. It's in the flyweight division. Kim and Grasso, and Kim here is, Grasso's a -320. Lou, underdog, and we're taping this on Wednesday. It is National Dog Day, I should say, so we got to give them a little extra tip of the cap there.
Okay, so as I see this fight, the biggest issue in this fight for Grasso, who's the big favorite, is that she started her career at 115, and now she moves up to a 125 fight. She's a Mexican fighter with a great ground game, but Mexican fighters strike, and she's going to try and strike with the young lady from South Korea. The South Korean fighter is going to be a little taller, a little more experienced, have a 6-inch reach advantage, and really she's dropping into 125 from the bantamweight division. So at this point in time, I really lean heavily to the South Korean fighter. I believe she's going to be the much bigger lady come weigh-ins. And so because of this weight dynamic, I'm really choosing to wait, watch the weigh-ins. And if both of these ladies weigh in without any kind of issue, I think I'm going to find Kim to be the much stronger, larger physical woman. And I'm going to lean to her as an underdog.
I absolutely love Kim as well, and I agree with Lou. And one of the things that he talked about was that big reach advantage, the height advantage. You know, Kim stands 5'7", Alexa Grasso just 5'5". But what's really interesting is with Grasso is, although she was known as this elite striker coming in, maybe one of the more hyped kickboxers coming into the UFC out of Mexico, all three of her UFC wins at 115 pounds were by decision. And every time she stepped up in class at all, Tatiana Suarez, Felice Harry, Carla Esparza, it resulted in a loss for Alexa Grasso. Now she's going to move up against a much bigger woman. I think it's one of those situations, and I hate to compare Alexa Grasso to Paige VanZant. And again, Paige VanZant wasn't horrible. I don't want anyone to think that. She was very good, but she was never actually going to be a legit contender in the UFC. And the same thing with Alexa Grasso. At a time when the UFC started doing more cards in Mexico, she was an attractive woman. She has this great stand-up striking game, and they thought that they could potentially make her into a superstar, but her overall MMA game just wasn't there. She lost every time she stepped up at 115 pounds. She got way too much credit for beating Carolina Kowalkiewicz at a time when she was really shot and losing all her fights. So I think Grasso may be one of the more overrated fighters in all of women's MMA, at least in the UFC side. And Kim is surging here a little bit, 3-2 in the UFC. Her losses both to very legit fighters, Antonia Shevchenko, the sister of the 125-pound champion, and Lucia Pudikova, both very tough competition. She has some good wins. She just scored a knockout in her last fight over a fighter much bigger and Alexa Grasso. I think Kim's very live here. And in a fight where the total being 2.5 rounds over minus 370 means we're likely to go the distance here, that also favors the bigger, stronger, taller fighter who's probably going to make this weight a little and carry the weight a little bit better. Kim plus 260 seems like a steal to me as well.
All right, so passing on the total essentially, but you do like the underdog there. Steal, I like that. You don't hear that very often with a dog on the money line. Featherweight division for the next fight. What are we looking at for here? I don't see a line here for Lamas and Algeo. I mean, this is a what can you tell me about this here, Matthew?
So it's Lamas minus 260. 2.5 over minus 120 right now. This is a little bit of a difficult fight to break down. I have somewhat of a lean toward the under just because Ricardo Lamas, who's now 38 years old, he's 1-3 in his last four fights. He got knocked out by Calvin Kattar. He got knocked out by Josh Emmett. He actually got a knockout win. The one win he has in his last four fights was a KO over Darren Elkins. Darren Elkins is known for being tough, for just eating immense amount of damage in his fight. So the fact that Lamas was able to get the KO there, I actually think is amazing. But his durability has also been challenged lately. 5 of his 8 losses are by knockout. He seems to be a little chinny as he's getting up there in age. There's a lot of fighters, that's the case, right? The first thing to go on a lot of fighters is the chin. But they say the last thing to go is the power. And that seems to be the case with Ricardo Lamas. The power is definitely still there. The chin certainly isn't. The problem is on the other side, Allegro, a.k.a. Senor Perfecto, as his name, his nickname is, 5-1 in his last 6 fights. But all of his fights are on the regional scene. So a lot of people don't know how good this guy is. I've actually seen him fight several times. He has a lot of fights against UFC stars, or at least UFC mainstays right now. He fought Hurricane Shane Burgos. He fought Jaron Gordon on the regional scene. This is a guy who has been in there with some serious UFC guys. So the experience is there for Perfecto, who is significantly younger than Lamas. I did lean toward the under, but the one thing that makes me nervous here is perhaps the underdog's a little bit better value because Algeo has never been stopped ever. And let's face it, if Ricardo Lamas is going to win this fight, it's probably going to be by knockout. He's facing a guy who's never been KO'd in his career. Can he get the KO win over Lamas? Can Lamas be the first guy to knock him out? I think both are possible. Either way, in the small cage, Ricardo Lamas' only path to victory nowadays seems to be via knockout, and his chin doesn't seem to be holding up well. So I took under 2.5 rounds plus 100.
What about you, Lou?
I have no real feel for this fight. Everything Matthew says is factual and on point. The one area that I'll disagree with just a little is that Lamas is a wrestling-based fighter who fell in love, like wrestlers do, they fall in love with their hands. And while he can strike, his chin, just like wrestlers, is his Achilles heel. For Lamas to win this fight, he's going to have to wrestle Allegro up. If he stands with a guy that's 3 inches taller with a reach advantage, which Algeo has, he's going to get iced again. So I look for Lamas to go out and try and wrestle in this fight. I think he's washed. I really don't want anything to do with the final.
Okay, fair enough. The next fight, very anticipated after the controversial stoppage. Kudalaba really was furious after the bout. He's a nearly 3-1 dog, plus 270, plus 280, depending on your book. This was right. The original fight occurred before the pandemic, so this is a very anticipated fight. Lou, I would imagine you're on the dog here.
No, I think Kudalaba he's totally uneven mentally. He's dangerous with his hands, of course. He's recovering from COVID. I don't see that being any kind of issue for him, but there's you know, even though he can take people down, he averages 2.6 takedowns per 15 minutes of fight time, which is stunning. His IQ is low. He's a hothead, and he's in against a Russian vice grip.
Low. I love it.
The Russian has high IQ. He has 85% takedown defense and great striking. This is simply a mismatch, except Kudalaba will make it compelling because he's going to come right out and try and engage with Ankalaev, which I think is going to be, once again, a mistake.
I agree with Lou there. I think that a lot of people are going to make the case for Kudalaba because of his resume. You know, he's been in there with so many top guys like Jared Cannonier, with Glover Teixeira. Of course, he ended up on the losing end of all those fights. And more so here, I mean, he's the smaller guy, and, you know, he tried all these crazy tactics. If you remember what was crazy about last fight is it wasn't just the fact that they had that really quick stoppage on those head kicks that never actually landed when they show the replay. None of those head kicks actually landed on Kudalaba, who, although did appear to be rocking or trying to play possum. But if you remember right before the fight, when they came out to touch gloves, Kudalaba was screaming at Ankalaev and bumped into him, and the ref had to break them up. And I remember the same ref who had the controversial stoppage there actually had to go to Kudalaba before the fight and say, "What are you doing? You're going to get the fight in 2 seconds." I mean, this guy, to Lou's point, is mentally unstable. He tried all these intimidation tactics in the first fight, and when the fight actually started, Ankalaev came out as cool as a cucumber, not phased at all, not rushed at all, took his time, set up the kicks, went to the body, went to the legs. At the end of the day, I think the longer this goes, the more trouble Kudalaba is going to be in. Where I do think there might be some value is everybody assumes that this thing's going to be a first round knockout. And I actually think Ankalaev is going to take his time. And Kudalaba is tough. I mean, this is a guy who's been in there with big time power guys like Glover Teixeira, like, Jared Cannonier, and they didn't get him out of there. I mean, he could take some shots. And I think after the quick stoppage in the first time, a lot of times what happens when you get a controversial stoppage is in a rematch, the referee is going to tend to give him a longer leash here. It's only 1.5 rounds, and it's a pick'em. I think at minus 110, over 1.5, I wouldn't be surprised if this thing makes it late into the second round or early into the third round. I think Kudalaba might be at risk of getting stopped as the fight continues and he starts to fatigue and eating damage. But I think overall, Ankalaev doesn't come out as explosive as people think. He takes his time. He's really a precision striker. I think, you know, while everyone's going to assume under in this fight, I wouldn't be surprised if we get 7.5 minutes out of these two.
And it had the early stoppage in the last fight, so maybe the referee's aware of that. Maybe don't pull the stoppage and go a little bit in case there's a mini comeback.
Go ahead, Luke. Excuse my interruption. Matthew, first of all, you're really good with totals, and that breakdown was outstanding. I totally agree with what you just said. I think there's compelling reason to consider this fight over for those reasons specifically.
All right, good stuff there. And look, with these kind of lines, I mean, every fight we talked about was either like 260 or higher on the main card, and it looks like that on the prelims as well with a lot of these. So it's you know, maybe there's just opportunity elsewhere with the totals. Let's go to the prelims card. Matthew, what are the, you know, two or three that stand out to you? And we'll let Lou respond as well afterward.
So I started, you know, I know that Lou and I are on one that's similar, but I'll let him start on that one. I'm going to start with Mallory Martin, Hannah Cyphers. Hannah Cyphers has looked bad. This is her third fight during the pandemic. She fought a fighter that was literally two weight classes above her in her last fight, and it showed, and she ended up getting stopped. And before that, she was in a great fight, and it looked like she might have a chance of winning as a huge underdog, and then got caught in a submission in an ankle lock in a situation where she probably was definitely winning the stand-up battle here. What's interesting about this is they're pricing this total over 2.5 rounds minus 260 like they would a standard women's fight, as if it's expected to go to the distance automatically. But when you look at each of these women, most, at least half of their wins come by finish. These are actually two finishers, and they tend to get finished when they lose. Hannah Cyphers has been finished in 5 of her last 6 losses. Mallory Martin is coming off a fight where she just got finished in her last fight. So neither one of these women are too durable. They both tend to get tapped when they get caught in tough submissions. They don't necessarily have the experience to fight out of tough submissions. So I think that there's at least a reasonably good chance, or at least a better chance of this fight not going the distance than the odds would suggest, and thus under 2.5 rounds in the plus 220 range certainly has value just from a mathematical standpoint when looking at these two's fights and how they tend to go. And I also think that underdog Hannah Cyphers is live here. She actually is stepping back down in class here against a woman who's going to be much more comparable in size, much more comparable in experience. You know, Mallory Martin's only 6-3 career. She doesn't have a ton of experience. And Hannah Cyphers has good hands. When she gets to stand and trade, she has good hands. At the end of the day, I'm playing both the underdog plus 260 and the under 2.5 rounds plus 200. And in a perfect dream situation, we'll get a Hannah Cyphers early KO.
So maybe a Cyphers inside the distance. Inside the distance would be lovely. And
yes,
that could really pay. Lou, what's your top card on the prelims? Or top pick, I should say.
Yes. And again, I'll try and be brief. So Matthew can come in and fill in some of the holes, but I'm going to take us to the fight that's at 185 middleweights, Di Chirico from Italy against Zach Cummings. Cummings from Factory X is important, and I'll get to that. He's a lefty. These guys are about the same size, though Cummings will have a slight reach advantage over Di Chirico. Di Chirico's primarily a striker. In 2011, he was playing linebacker for a football team in Italy. And so athletic, big, strong, sturdy, pretty well-rounded, but primarily he's a stand-up European striker who's erect and, to me, somewhat stiff. Cummings is the much more well-rounded fighter. He's got a wrestling base. His last fight against Akhmedov, the man that Weidman recently decisioned, was a loss, and it's bothered him. It was a loss he shouldn't have taken. I believe Cummings is the much more versed man, and even though he's 6 years older at 36, I think he has way more tools than Chirico, and the greatest advantage I think he has happened a couple of years ago when his teammate, Julian Marquez, faced off and actually fought Alesso Di Chirico. In that fight, Cummings was in the corner of Marquez. And it's unusual that Cummings was not only able to watch his teammate fight Di Chirico, but he got to take notes and observe the opponent with the thought that, hey, who knows, maybe one day we could fight. I think that's a great advantage for him. I know he comes in very prepared off a loss for this fight. And at plus 100, I think maybe the wrong man may be favored here.
Ooh. I completely agree with Lou. I was very surprised to see Di Chirico as the favorite here. I mean, he's 3-4 with a losing record in the UFC, and all four of those losses were no doubters. And again, a close decision wins over Julian Marquez and Bing Bose. And on the other side, that coming losses come against guys like Santiago Ponzinibbio, Gunnar Nelson, Michael Prezzeri, some of the best in the world at what they do.
And he tends to put away guys who aren't the very best in the world. He's 4-2 in his last six in the UFC. And he may be getting to that point at 36 years old where he's starting to slow down or at least be on the wrong side of the mountain in terms of his peak. But I still think Zach Cummings' experience, his showings against some of the best fighters in the world, I was very surprised to see him open as an underdog. And Cummings plus 100 is certainly on my card as well.
You guys are aware that that's the kiss of death, right? The wrong team favored, wrong guy favored.
Yep.
I say that, but I actually won. I think I said on the podcast, I actually won the last time I said that. So we're okay. We're okay. The jinx is over. Lou, any other plays jump out to you on this undercard?
Early in the night, a guy named Sean Brady, who's a really up-and-coming, explosive, dynamic, 170-pound welterweight, is going to fight a man with one UFC win under his belt, Christian Aguilera, who basically comes from the regional scene. Brady is a tough Philadelphian. He's on the short circuit ride straight up to the top. He thought he was going to get a little bit better opponent than this for this fight, but he's handled it very maturely. Aguilera is going to come out and meet him in the center of the octagon, and these two guys are going to throw down. Brady, in interviews, has definitely gunning for the impressive showing, and they gave him a guy that he can look impressive against. And I like the under in the fight. And the last I looked, the under in Brady Aguilera was plus 160, plus 170. So depending where you shop, that's a good underdog position that I'll be taking early in the evening.
I like that fight. And I do like the under because I do think if Aguilera is going to have any path to victory, it's going to be by knockout. I ended up passing on this one because I have a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth from Aguilera's last fight because I was actually on his opponent, Anthony Ivey. I actually thought that Ivey was going to come in and get rid of Aguilera quicker because Ivey was so much bigger, more athletic. And that Aguilera power, which is pretty renowned, this guy can punch. It showed up early, and he caught Ivy early, and it ended up being a knockout within the first minute of the fight. And I was on the wrong side of that one, unfortunately. I think if it had gone a few more minutes, Ivy would have got to start using his athleticism against Aguilera, who's pretty slow in there, but does have big-time power. So I really like Lou's position in that even if the underdog here was to pull another upset, it's most likely going to come in the first 3 minutes of the fight where that he's going to be fresh and he still has all that power in him. So either way, to lose points, smaller octagon, 25-foot cage, these two are going to meet in the middle. They can both bang. Aguilera's only path to victory is by knockout. It's hard to see this one going too long. Under certainly is a very sensible play and probably one that'll end up on my card as well.
Okay, cool. Matthew, any other plays?
No, that's it for me. Again, so many of this undercard, I mean, Sean Brady in that fight's minus 400. Almost the entire prelims is littered with minus 300 or better favorites. And, the whole goal for me, and I didn't think any of them, maybe Brady, but again, because of Aguilera's power, it was a little scary. I didn't know that any of them were deserved to be such big favorites. So I just looked to try to pick off a dog or two or a total that we could hit and ended up on ciphers. But, this is one of those we saw last week with some huge upsets in the UFC, one of the biggest upsets ever. And, across the card, there were some big upsets last week. And this also sets up as one of those cards where you have fighters that aren't normally minus 300 favorites into that role. I would just say to people, buyer beware on some of these big favorites on the prelims.
As well, what I will remind people is since the UFC kicked back up on May 9th, favorites are 1-12-49-4. That's 67.8%. So the favorites have been intoxicating. People are going to be running to them to bet their parlays. And I totally agree with Matthew. If you're refined, I don't think you can just win in 33-34% of the fights. You can't just blanket shotgun underdogs. But if you're judicious in your approach, you can find some live dogs. And I think Matthew pointed a few of them out today.
Okay. No, I think we did a great job just breaking down all this stuff. I think you guys obviously provide a lot of information. It's good to go kind of bouncing off one another. So thank you each for your time, and let's root these winners home.
All right, guys. Thanks. Best of luck, everybody.
Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Time now to bring in our next guest, Wes Reynolds of VSiN, and we really need some, I don't know, We Are the Champions, Queen music or something like that, because the man picked another winner. Well done, Dustin Johnson. Sniffed that one out. And what is that, your third winner in about 8 weeks here on the pod? So congratulations, my friend.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. And congratulations to you as well, the new deal with ESPN. So good weekend for both of us, sir.
Yeah, that's fair. Mine I knew was coming for, I just hadn't announced it yet. So we had talked, this had been going on throughout the pandemic. So, but more importantly, yeah, I'm just thrilled, excited. I appreciate that. And we get to kind of get rolling here in Las Vegas. So very kind of you to do that. So let's talk about this, hard right turn. Let's talk about this tournament this weekend. It's kind of, it's a long par 70, but there's really, it's hard to sort of, in the past, in the summer, we've talked about, oh, this is all about, iron game, or this is a short course, so we need, whatever. This is sort of just, we're not sure, at least in my mind, who's going to necessarily play well. There's no sort of one characteristic or trait you could pick out. How are you approaching this in a macro sense?
Yeah, when I look at this, Doug, we always say that distance never hurts, certainly on any course. But I think it's really that combination of guys that are good off the tee, guys that could keep it in the fairway, because you got some thick rough here. I don't think it's going to play like it ended up playing last weekend. And really, the course in Boston didn't play any harder or easier, I don't think, than it had in previous years. You just had a guy shoot 30 under par and just happened to get on one, as Dustin Johnson did. But I think this course, when you're looking at probably a winning score, you're going to be looking at maybe more mid-teens-ish, like 13 to 15 under. So it is going to be a little bit more difficult simply because the rough is going to be thick. It's about 4 to 5 inches high. So some of these guys, we've kind of seen it on the tour. It's been all the rage in terms of bomb and gouge. Hit it as hard as you can and as far as you can. And if you don't hit a fairway, you're close enough where you can bomb it out of thick stuff or gouge it out of thick stuff with a wedge or a shorter iron. But I think that that's going to be a little bit tough to do this week. It may play a little bit similar to what we saw in the PGA, where, yeah, the distance is going to help, but you've got to keep it in the fairway. And that's kind of what I looked at a little bit this week. I didn't necessarily go with the pure ball strikers in that sense. So I have some guys that are bombers, but I've also got some guys that I think are really, really accurate off the tee. And even if they sacrifice a little bit of distance, they're going to be in better positions to go after the pins.
Yeah, so obviously with the move and other things, I only did not break down the card fully. I have one guy on here because I think he's just sort of a dude who I want to back at 45-1. And that's Matt Wolf, a guy we've talked about on the pod before. I've had him in some other tournaments. And I don't know, it's just a guy I like, and he's great off the tee. I want to say top 20 in terms of driving distance, strokes gained off the tee. He's up there. But his putting has been terrible at times, but he's also put it together. He's got a top 5 finish in 2 tournaments, including the PGA Championship. And he also has 2 other top 25 finishes this year. So he kind of, when he gets hot and can hang with the big boys or the better, more consistent putters. So at 45-1, he's my lone play today.
Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner, because I'm also on Matt Wolf, or at least I hope we have a winner anyway. Right, but Matt Wolf was one of the first guys I played on this card. And you know what? Why not take the most recent winner in the field on this very course? And just to preface that, Olympia Fields hasn't hosted an event on the PGA Tour since the 2003 U.S. Open. So you really don't have a lot of course history to go on, but you've got to get a little bit creative here. And one event that does get played here at Olympia Fields very regularly, actually annually, is what is called the Fighting Illini Olympia Fields Invitational. And that's obviously a college golf event. And the last guy in the field that won on this course was Matt Wolf right here in 2008 in the fall season. And that was before he won the NCAA individual Division I championship when he was at Oklahoma State. So he's a guy that's won on this course. It's one of the better college invitationals that you'll see. Actually, I believe it was Wolf first and Colin Morikawa second, who I'll get to in a moment. But I think course experience, look, it could absolutely matter. And I think this is a guy that has seen this course. This is a guy that I think, like you mentioned, one of the longer hitters on tour in terms of distance, strokes gained off the tee. And I think that that's going to matter in certain spots, because with the par 70, you've only got two par fives on this track, but both the par fives are over 600 yards. So only the longer hitters, only the Matt Wolfs, only the DeChambeaus, who won the U.S. Amateur here in 2015, only the Dustin Johnsons, only the Rory McIlroys, the really super long hitters, are the only guys that are going to be able to reach these in two shots. It's going to be a three-shot hole on these par fives for even most of the field. So, and you also got par fours, 12 of them, but seven of them are 450 yards or longer. So you got some 500 yards par fours. So that means you're going to have, it's not just going to be driver, wedge, putt. It's going to be driver, and maybe you got to hit some five irons or some four irons in here. So you got to be pretty good with your long irons. But Matt Wolf was certainly a guy that stood out to me. And while I mentioned him, I'll go ahead and mention Colin Morikawa, who I only got a 20-1. I wanted a little bit of a better number. He's not a huge hitter, but look, what we saw at the PGA, he's good enough to where his accuracy and his ball striking is going to more than compensate for any lack of distance. And we really saw that materialize at Harding Park. And I think maybe he gets a little bit forgotten about because this is changing every week. I mean, we're getting like a new number one player in the world every single week. DJ gets the ranking with his win at Boston last weekend. But Morikawa missed the cut at the Northern Trust. But the one thing about missed cuts is they're not all equal. It's not necessarily a zero-sum game. That missed cut, I think, was kind of excusable because the guy just came off winning his first major 2 weeks ago. So it was like, okay, you know, he's going to probably throw in a clunker at some point, maybe just a little bit rusty or whatnot. But before they missed cut in Boston last week at the Northern Trust, he was ninth, fourth, second, and first in the respective fields he was in for driving accuracy. And I think this is a kid, you know, he's just 23 years old, but he's proven he can respond to adversity. If you recall earlier in the summer, he missed his first cut. I think he'd made like 20-some cuts in a row. He'd never missed a cut as a PGA touring professional dating back to last year when he finally turned pro. He missed the cut at the Travelers. And then 2 weeks later, what does he do? He goes on and wins the Workday Open at Muirfield Village in a playoff. So this is a guy that I think gets knocked down but gets up off the deck very quickly, doesn't let it linger in his mind. He's pretty unflappable. So Colin Morikawa at 20-1, and also, as I mentioned earlier, experience on this course from playing in college at Cal, finished second to Wolf in 2018.
Yeah, no, look, we've talked about Morikawa obviously winning the major. I mean, it's just these guys are so good, so young, and he's in that tier of those young guys even before the PGA Championship victory. And you know, you obviously, what was he, 33-1 at that tournament? And so there's sort of apprehension to only grab him at 20-1, but we now know how good of a golfer he is. So I'm not scared, but I'm not turned off by taking a guy who could have had a handful of tournaments ago at a better price. We talked about this with Berger, right? Everyone's like, oh, Daniel Berger, who the heck is this guy? Why am I only getting 30-1? These guys are better than we originally thought. So the market has calmed down, but the question is you have to assess it through a different lens. And is he better than the odds are offering? So it sounds like you find value in 20-1. Right? What is it, 5% basically has to win this tournament? And you think there's a better than 5% chance. It's as simple as that. And if it's 8%, 9%, whatever, then there's value at 20-1. Now, sometimes you have to change your unit size to obtain maybe the desired outcome, like with DJ 20-1. I mean, you had six plays. Obviously, your longer shots, probably not the same unit size as you would put on the 20-1. Payout, but you can't hit the big long shot all the time. So DJ at 20-1 was a great score, and I can't fault you for Morikawa at all at 20-1. I mean, who's looked better this year, right? The last, I don't know, 3 months, no one.
Yeah, and kind of following the pattern of what we see on the PGA Tour, it's kind of like what I've been able to do. While they haven't been huge prices, I've been able to get some guys on some drifts. Morikawa not necessarily drifting here, but when I got DJ at the Travelers at 25-1, he kind of drifted up a little bit, where it's like, okay, that's the right price to maybe take him, because he gets forgotten about, because everybody looks at Rahm, or everybody was looking at Schauffele, or looking at Rory McIlroy to really come out firing after the restart. And sometimes these guys drift up a little bit, and that was the same thing with John Rahm at the Memorial, who we have. When he got up to like 22-1, I was like, well, wait a minute, this guy has won double digit times in the last when you combine like the last two and a half years. So now you all of a sudden get him at a price. And that's why I was a little bit tempted with Rory McIlroy this week, because I saw him in the 18s. I wanted to see him more in the 20s. But at some point, we're going to get to a point, because the market shifts from week to week. So at some point, you're going to be looking at Rory McIlroy, even though he doesn't have a top 10 so far in terms of the restart this summer, where if he's getting in that 20, 22 something to one range, then you're going to want to have to take him at some point. So that's really one way you kind of got to play this futures market, is try to get some guys on some drifts where you're not getting them at the 12-1 or the 14-1, but when they get to the 20 pluses, then it's okay to jump in.
How do you sniff out those drifts other than what you just explained?
Well, I mean, it's just kind of looking at market, because one of the things, it's like any other sport betting market, Doug. People like to bet, and people like to price in terms of the market what they saw last.
Sure.
And obviously, what they see last is Dustin Johnson. Let's say Dustin Johnson gets a top five or a top 10 last week. He's not in some places, even with a shorter field with only 70 players this week, he's not 9-1 or 10-1. He's probably like 15 or 16-1. So that's what they're going to do. People are going to be more apt to bet what they saw last. And then they see a guy miss a cut, and it's like all of a sudden we want nothing to do with him. And I guess I could use another play that I have this week as a better analogy or explanation for that. I'm going to stick with Jason Day for one more week, and he's around the 30-1-ish range. Look, he had four straight top seven finishes. He was right there at the PGA. This looked like the good spot last week for him to really break through and with the win, to get his first win in about 27 months. And he had been hitting the ball really well. Ball striking had been good. But then last week, too many of us kind of got in that boat. And what happens is the boat tips over and Jason Day missed the cut. He was near the bottom of the field in strokes gained approach, where he had been near the top in the last several weeks coming in. So he got a little bit too popular, and that kind of happens. And that's what happened with Day. He misses the cut. But now when everybody kind of abandoned ship a little bit, because look, when you bet on a team and they don't get there for you, you're like, okay, I'm done with this team. And sometimes, right. Sometimes you stick with the team too long, because we as bettors are stubborn. But sometimes you maybe jump off the ship a little bit early, and we tend to overreact to maybe one or two events. So Day is somebody I stuck with that I think may be off everybody's radar this week. And he's at about 30, low 30s-1 right now.
No, the first time you hit with DJ, he shot like a 64. No, it was John Rahm, shot like a 64 on Sunday the previous week. Mm-hmm. Played well, then they were re-racking it at Memorial. And so you thought that'd be a good maybe you found something, because you were getting like, I don't know, 7-1 better than, you know, eight, went from like 12-1 to 19-1 or whatever it was. And that was a way to sort of catch him on the buy low, so to speak. So yeah, I mean, that's the way to do it. And I'm glad you were able to explain that. So thank you for doing that. Any other plays for you?
Yeah, the shortest price guy that I took this week, and he was actually the last one I added. I didn't get the best number on him. I could have gotten maybe 18, maybe 20s in some places, but I took Xander Schauffele at 16-1, and that was just a pure stat play, basically, because he fits the profile. He had a nice weekend last weekend, made the cut on the number, but shot a pair of 67s. Finished a little bit down in the field, like I think T25 is where he was, but you look at the stat ratings, he's third in greens in regulation, he's fourth in scrambling, he's fifth in par four scoring average, which is going to matter this week considering 12 of the 18 holes are par fours, and then the tee to green game, he's fifth tee to green, he's also seventh in strokes gained off the tee. The kind of a little bit of the shaky part of his game has been the approaches, but I think if he keeps it in the fairway, which is not going to be easy to do for some of these bombers, that's why I kind of skirted Bryson a little bit this week, even though he's capable of winning here, having won the 2015 U.S. Amateur here at Olympia Fields. But can he keep it in the short grass, so to speak? Can he not get in the thick stuff? And Xander is a guy that I think can really avoid that, Mark. So I use Xander, and then kind of back to that college angle. Here's a guy that was right there at the PGA Championship a couple weeks ago, ended up only finishing tied for 10th, but was right there in the mix on Sunday. And you get a little bit of a big price on him. He's around anywhere from 80 to 90 to 1. And he also has a win on this course, and that's Cameron Champ, who, like Matt Wolf, won the Fighting Illini Invitational at Olympia Fields. That was back in 2016 when Champ was playing for Texas A&M. And look, a really big hitter, Cameron Champ. I think he's right behind Bryson DeChambeau. I believe he's number two on the PGA Tour in driving distance. And we've seen a couple of the PGA Championship contenders with that week in between where a lot of the guys didn't play the Wyndham. Did go on to have good weeks last week. Obviously, DJ with the win. Scottie Scheffler was right there. He shot a 59 on Friday. So he was right there, and Scheffler was right in the mix at the PGA. So maybe the guys like Wolf and Champ are kind of the guys this week that rebound from the near miss at the PGA and go on and do well. And then one other point I did want to make, when you're looking, and if you look and do that research of that Fighting Illini Invitational, you'll see a decent amount of guys in this field have played this course, and they're not really household names, so you're probably not going to maybe want to bet them in the outright markets. But I think this is a really good tournament if maybe you want to do a little bit of experimenting with your golf betting. That's not saying necessarily go all in where you're betting too many guys and using too much of your bankroll, but this is a good prop market week. And I'd say like top 20 type of props for guys that were decent college players that played pretty solid here. Maybe they're not apt to win against the elite of the elite in the FedEx Cup event, but I'll mention a few names for that. Robbie Shelton, Taylor Gooch, Dylan Fratelli, Maverick McNealy, Harry Higgs. These are guys that are going to be down there a little bit on the board that may not be great outright bets, but you can bet them top 10s and top 20s. Like top 20s, you'd be getting 5-1, 6-1 in that range. So top 10s, you'd be looking 10, 12, 14-1. Because I just have a feeling, Doug, that there's going to be a couple of these guys that get on that leaderboard. Maybe they're not going to be threats to win the event outright at the end, but you want to use some of these guys, I think, for top 20s. And plus, this is a FedEx Cup event. So you've got to get a really high finish if you want to advance to next week in Atlanta at East Lake for the Tour Championship. Only the top 30 advance. And some of these guys are obviously safely in the top 30. One I'll mention, Webb Simpson, who withdrew from this event, who's sitting third in the FedEx Cup points. So he's not going to drop very much if he takes this week off. He's pretty much set for Atlanta. So, you know, you've got some spots that are going to be spoken for from the elite guys that have already won. I mean, DJ, Rom, all these guys, they're going to be in Atlanta. So you've probably only got a handful of spots that really could be claimed for next week. So you're going to see some of these guys that are maybe rated in the 50 to 55 range and below that really got to get going and go low and have a top 3 to 5 finish here to be able to advance. And one that I mentioned, McNealy, he was my long bomb play. And I leaned more on the prop side for him, but I did bet him small on the outright. He's 250-1. And he's one of the better putters on tour. Putting's like really his strength. He's, I think, 10th in strokes gained putting, but sometimes, Doug, I like these narrative plays when I'm filling out my card, because we all go on the same stuff. We go on course form, we go on recent form, we go on statistics and whatnot, and now, and you know, analytics, what have you. But sometimes I like a good narrative. And McNealy, the last major tournament that was held here at Olympia Fields in terms of a top level golf main tour level was the 2017 Women's PGA Championship at Olympia Fields. The winner of that event was Danielle Kang. And who is Danielle Kang's boyfriend? That would be Maverick McNealy, who is 250-1. McNealy also was a two-time winner. One time he was co-medalist on this course in that college Fighting Illini Invitational I mentioned. So, you know, it's at least a long shot that kind of fits the narrative. Now, he could go ahead and be the bottom of the leaderboard because, I mean, he's a guy that was, I think he was tied for 61st last week, but he led the field in putting, so that tells you he really didn't hit the ball very well. But you know what? Sometimes you throw in these bombs and you just catch them on the right week, and maybe McNealy could fit that bill here. And now, also keep in mind, for matchup purposes, only 70 players in here, so this is a no-cut event. So these guys are all going to play four rounds here. So if you're playing tournament matchups and you fall behind a little bit early, you still got time, so you don't have to worry about if they got to make the cut on the number on Friday.
Okay, so don't be deterred if guys are typically slow starters too.
Absolutely.
All right, my man. Great stuff as always. Stay hot, as they say.
We'll try, man. You stay hot out here now that you're back out here in Las Vegas, and it's pretty steamy here in the summer.
I was about to say, I don't need to try. It is. It's warm, but you know what? As they say, no humidity, and it's actually not that bad. I was so worried about, you know, kind of wearing shorts to work and then bringing my blazers and whatever. But, like, I just wear my, you know, nice clothes. It's fine. Like, I'm totally comfortable or whatever. It got a little warm.
Well, you were dodging a tropical storm a couple weeks ago. So, I guess we look at the bright side of the weather here.
Yeah, yes, we do. Well said. Well said, my friend. I will see you soon.
All right, Doug, and good to hear from you.
Kicking is for losers.
Okay, so thanks to Wes Reynolds for his top-notch analysis, and thanks to Lou and Matthew for the same in the UFC. Should be an exciting card this weekend. I'm fired up for all of it, and to be out here, and it's just good to – now I need to figure out where I'm going to live. Living in the hotel room right now, Christina, so a lot of moving parts. But I am excited to be out here, and I'm excited to see what we can do with this podcast. As this will continue, maybe we'll tweak some formats here and there and different guests, obviously being based in Las Vegas, but it's still during the pandemic. We're still trying to figure out a lot of things in the media world. So thanks to everyone for their listenership, their loyalty, rating, reviewing, subscribing, all that fun stuff. And football season just around the corner. We're obviously going to have an NFL preview as well coming up before kickoff in a little over 2 weeks. So stay safe out there, and we will continue to join you from Las Vegas.